Call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order and let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, February 6, 2019. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum. Present are Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Giesel, Senator Bishop, Senator Keel, Senator Kawasaki, and myself, Chairman Birch. And I don't think I see any legislators in the audience here. Today, we will hear from the Department of Natural Resources on two issues. Number one, the state's efforts to assert and preserve public access on roads, trails, and waterways. And secondly, an update on the transfer of federal lands under the Statehood Act. Leading the presentation will be Brent Goodrum, DNR Deputy Commissioner, James Walker, DNR Public Access Assertion and Defense Unit Manager, Jesse Alloway, Department of Law Assistant Attorney General. At this time, if the presenters could come forward and we'll come to the table, we'll ask you to state your name for the record and to begin your presentation. Thank you for being here this afternoon.
Great. Thank you, Chair. For the record, my name is Brent Goodrum. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. I've had the honor and privilege of serving within department for about approaching 8 years now, previously serving as the director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Perhaps as we get to their speaking parts, we'll allow them to do their introductions at that point. But first and foremost, this is a team effort, not only between DNR and Department of Law. Fish and Game is also a critical partner in this effort, as well as the legislature and the administration in supporting these efforts. These issues are critically important to state, not only today, but years from now, because these activities that we talk about have lasting impacts. Fundamentally, land and access to our resources are core to who we are and what we do within this great state. And so I'm very excited to be sharing this information with you all here today. Next slide. The topics that we hope to address for you today, on the front end, I'll talk a little bit about our remaining statehood land entitlement and some of the obstacles for us to overcome in achieving that. I'll talk a little bit about public land order 5150. Many of you know that to be the TAPS corridor, why that's important to us. I'll also highlight efforts with regards to the ANWR boundary dispute that's still ongoing between the federal government and the state of Alaska. And then we'll transition, and Jesse and Jim will talk about our efforts on navigability and access via RS-2477s throughout the state.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I'd like to let the record reflect Senator Reinbold has joined us. Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I have a brief at ease, please?
Take a brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record here. It's about 3:43 in the afternoon. Please proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As everyone here knows today, Alaska is generally the exception to most any rule. When it comes to land entitlement, the state was granted approximately 105.8 million acres, both through the statehood land entitlement as well as other authorizations subsequent to that. Those grants of land are both inclusive of both surface and the mineral estate, which is really important. Additionally, the Statehood Act made the provisions of the Submerged Lands Act of 1953 and the Equal Footing Doctrine applicable to Alaska. This also has added an estimated 30 to 40 million acres of tidelands and submerged lands and an estimated 3 to 6 million acres of shorelands underlying our navigable water bodies to our land estate. Importantly, one other piece of legislation, the Alaska National Interest in Lands Conservation Act, later established the state's ability to top file our selections over lands that were not yet available for selection. And so that's a really important component of our land entitlement. As you can see on this slide, this is just a portrayal of that approximately 105.8 million acres. 68 million of those are currently patented already to the state, which means that survey work's already been done. The 32.4 million acres of tentatively approved lands, those are lands that the state already has management authority to, and so we have the full ability to manage those, to sale or lease those lands. They just haven't had their survey work yet to confirm the acreage. Quite often in the process, when they survey it, the land, due to either inholdings or meanderable water bodies, those are then taken out. So a lot of times, lands that you would have, say, assumed had 160 acres when surveyed may only have 120 acres that are actually conveyed to the state. And so there's a little bit of a correction that comes back to us that adds to our remaining entitlement in the end. We're currently looking at about 5.3 million acres of land that are due to the state, which are some of our really important opportunities yet before the state. Next slide. Some of the obstacles to overcome yet for fully realizing our statehood land entitlement, one of them is Public Land Order 5150. Many of you know that as the TAPS corridor. There's approximately 1.74 million acres of some of our highest priority lands within that corridor. It's currently part of the Central Yukon Resource Management Plan that the BLM is currently working on. They're currently working two plans, the Bering Sea Western Interior Plan, which we anticipate will be the first one that the federal government will next release, followed shortly by the Central Yukon Plan. One of the challenges or issues that we've seen in recent years with plans are the use of the areas of critical environmental concern. These are areas that are, certain provisions are put upon those that restrict certain activities, and we've seen over the last several years that those ACECs have become larger in scope and more problematic for the state's intended use or access across some of those lands. And so particularly in the eastern interior, the use of the ACECs was perhaps excessive, I think was the state's point of view, and there's potential to revisit some of those.
Chairman, I might just state a word that he didn't say, maybe delicately, but it really turns out to be wilderness characteristics, and it bumps up against the no more clause in our ANILCA guarantees. So I think it's important for us to know that and to undergird what you're trying to do. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I figured I better say the W word before we get too far into this.
Sure. Good point. Another just a sidebar, Deputy Commissioner. It was the prior slide, the pie chart. I didn't have that in our packet. So is that a new slide, that one?
It is not a new slide. We'll make sure that you have that okay. one if it's well, not in your
fair
slide.
Fair enough. Deck, I was thumbing through here and see if it was out of order. But yeah, okay. If you could provide that, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thank Proceed. You, Chair. Public land orders are one of the other things. I mean, PLO 5150 is the most obvious critical one. 5150 should, in the Central Yukon Plan, if BLM were to choose in their alternatives to either lift in its entirety, or the vast majority of that PLO, the state could look to bring in close to 1 million acres, give or take 250,000 thereabout, of high priority lands. That not only provides us access to the North Slope, which is obviously our critical area of development, but the area of the Ambler Road would kick off out of the 5150 corridor as well as access to other areas like the Chandler Mining District. A lot of those areas are accessed from 5150, and so the state is very anxious to see that PLO lifted. And over a number of decades, the state has asked for it to be lifted, but we think within the near term, we should finally see that realized. 51 public land orders, as discussed, and to Senator Coghill's point, the presence of public land orders or military withdrawals quite often pull lands out of the public domain, and quite often they're viewed as small W wilderness because they restrict other activities. When public land orders are on, they prevent mining activities or the location of minerals, and so the state is generally very much in favor and has encouraged the federal government to lift these public land orders that no longer serve the purpose for which they were originally established. Many of these have been in place for decades. D1 withdrawals, that's a provision within ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Those withdrawals were intended to for studying classification. They are still present throughout the state, and they're one of the major reasons that some of our highest priority lands are unavailable to the state for selection. Next slide. Just lastly, I'll touch a little bit more here on Public Land Order 5150. As you know, it was created in 1971 for the build out of the TAPS pipeline for the North Slope down to Valdez. It is a vital transportation and access corridor. Within it, like I mentioned earlier, access to the west, should the Ambler project start, it will kick off from within that corridor, as well as many other mineralized areas that are in the area that are of great interest to the state. One other thing I want to lastly touch upon with regards to public land orders. One of the other we were able to lift this past year was 709 acres immediately adjacent to Fort Knox. This was a parcel that was known as the Gilmore parcel. And those of you from the Fairbanks area understand what that additional land to the state means and how important it is. The potential of that parcel could mean an extended operating life of the mine for another decade. And not only to the area and community of Fairbanks, but also to the Mental Health Trust. The Mental Health Trust, since 1994, when it was reconstituted, there were about 1,100 acres that were put into the trust, which is principally where the Fort Knox mine is. But through the success of Fort Knox, that effort has generated over $24 million for the beneficiaries of the trust. And so that's just a really important aspect. So we've got 5.3 million acres left or more. Our prudent use and best use of those lands is to continue to identify resources that allow the state to continue to build jobs and economy and help our opportunity for the state.
Question, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Goodrum. That remaining 5 million acres, do you have a ballpark on how much of that might be tentatively encumbered, waiting approval?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, currently BLM does not convey the state land unless we ask for it. So generally, the turnaround from when we give a request to BLM to convey lands to the state, the turnaround is generally expeditious. There have been times, and I'll speak to it here in a moment when I talk about the Canning and Staines, when we have requested lands. In that situation, it took them over 14 months to get us an answer, and their answer was no, for various reasons, and I'll explain a little bit of that. But generally, when the state goes to the BLM with a high priority land conveyance, the turnaround is generally quite fast, and we have the ability to do it. When there's an issue of a public land order or something that needs to happen, as was the case with Fort Knox, I know that took an exceedingly long time. There was a lot of work that was done with NOAA, which was the federal agency that the public land order was there for. There was a lot of careful work that was done to ensure that the land that was lifted was excess land to them and it didn't interfere with their, I believe, satellite systems that they have in the area. That took a long time. Most other PLOs should not take that long of a time.
Follow up?
Specifically, what I was asking, I apologize for not making myself clear. How many, let's say, how many applications are in your shop from Alaskans wanting to transfer federal land, state federal mining claims and the state mining claims, or as an example, how many orders do you have in your shop, from Alaskans?
Sure. That's a great question. Through the chair, Senator Bishop, in recent years, we've developed a plan and a process where there are federal mining claims that are top filed by state selections, and there's an avenue that allows them to relinquish their federal claim and then transfer over to the state, provided that they're the individual who has overstaked themselves with at-risk state claims. I've got a sheet with me today that I can share with you later that have shown the number of ones that we've successfully transferred, the number of ones that we have in process, the ones that we believe that are on our side of the fence for being worked, and ones that either BLM or the miner that were due some answers back. So that is an important aspect of conveying some of these inholdings and getting these lands into state ownership, that miners have the ability to work with the state then on their permits and those other applications. I don't have the exact number right in front of me, but I can work with you after this, sir.
Thank you. Proceed.
All right. I'd like to transfer now just to the last topic I want to talk about. Another significant opportunity that we within DNR and the state are relentlessly in pursuit of a favorable resolution, and this has to do with the ANWR boundary dispute. Pre-statehood 1957 time frame, Fish and Wildlife Service put an application out to create the Arctic Wildlife Range, which is now also known as the refuge. But so pre-statehood, they put an application in. Statehood was in 1959. In 1960, the federal government actually published the Federal Register Notice for Public Land Order 2214, which described what this range would look like. In the mid-1960s, BLM began to do survey work in the area. Around that same time, the state had put a general grant selection on these lands. Initial decision was made by BLM that tentatively approved lands to the state immediately to the west of the Canning River. For some reason, the state asked the federal government to clarify where exactly the boundary was. BLM corrected its answer, took some of that acreage back, and pointed to survey work they had done in the 1960s, saying, this is where we believe the boundary is. In 2013, and just before that, there was an offshore lease sale, oil and gas, that the question came up as essentially, where is our off-coast, where is our offshore boundary? That issue brought to light that this land boundary dispute was still very much active and needed resolution. We've been to the field out there a couple different times, examining and actually walking the ground, and understanding what was described in the public land order was a riparian boundary. It's supposed to be the mean high water of the west bank of the Canning River. Where it was surveyed on the ground is not that. It's tundra. In 2014, the state had put forth a request to BLM to convey lands west of the Canning River. As I mentioned earlier, it took about 14 months before BLM came back and said, we're not going to convey this. We believe that these lands are within ANWR. The state has appealed that decision to the IBLA, where that issue sits. BLM then looked to finalize their survey work. If you look way down at the bottom, that last, that's a township in the bottom left-hand corner that's got the bottom yellow segment into it. BLM had surveyed all the way down to that line, that top of that township. And then in 2014, they looked to finalize that work by, again, on the tundra, identifying where their last boundary marker was, and taking that over to the Canning River. And in doing so, they described it as a fixed and limiting boundary as opposed to a riparian boundary. We protested that survey work. BLM denied it. We appealed it to the IBLA and said these two issues are related, and the IBLA agreed with the state and said that these issues were live and they were connected. So as of May in 2018, both the state and BLM have made both of their final briefings to the IBLA, and that is where the issue currently sits. There is a delay in IBLA decisions. That's the Interior Board of Land Appeals. We're anticipating possibly another 18 to 24 months, possibly, for some sort of ruling. But everything is briefed up to the IBLA. They, you know, they could issue a decision soon. I don't know that we're overly optimistic that that's going to happen. But this is really important, and part of the reason it's important, as the last bullet points out, is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. Obviously, that legislation that was passed in the Congress modified the revenue sharing agreement within the Coastal Plain. It went from a 90-10 split from state to federal to a 50-50 split. There is potential that, you know, the federal government may figure out it may not choose to lease areas that are in contention with the state. The aspect is if the state were to rightfully own that area that's in yellow on that slide, the state would have full management authority and the ability to generate all the revenues that come from that land. Point Thompson is just about 7 miles along the coast from that yellow strip of land as you head west. Point Thompson we know to be a prolific gas reservoir, critically important to the state and its future hope for a gas line. But this is an important decision, and we're very hopeful that we can find a way to get a good resolution so that lands that were intended and meant to be put into land ownership can be done so, and that the state can benefit from its resources.
Question for you.
Yes, sir.
Deputy Commissioner, will that compromise or hold up or derail the federal effort to proceed with a lease sale within ANWR? I'm just wondering if I just asking the question as to whether if that tussle can be kind of set aside, or is it part and parcel to whether they the lease proceeding, right? Lease sale.
Chairman Birch, I believe that the federal government will make some sort of decision to de-risk any decision they have going forward, and so potentially they may just choose not to say anything or make any definitive determinations with that land, but that's just a hypothesis or guess. The other part I just wanted to share was that obviously in that Tax Cut and Jobs Act, there was a limitation of 2,000 acres of disturbance for footprint for production or support facilities on federal land. And so if that land is not federal land but state land, that's also very important to the future development of some of the Coastal Plain area. And so I just wanted to highlight that other issue for you all. And I'm hoping now that we transition and share some of the great work the state has done on navigability and access. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? No? Go ahead. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jesse Alloway, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Natural Resources Section of the Department of Law. I've talked with the committee before about these topics, but I know we have some new committee members. So just generally, the deputy mentioned this, the state owns all submerged lands underlying navigable in fact or tidally influenced waterways. Navigable, in fact, is a federal test, and when we're trying to prove navigability, we generally focus on four things. One is the waterway must be capable or susceptible to use as a highway for commerce. So with this, we're generally talking about whether you can transport people or goods on the river way. In the 1980s, the Ninth Circuit told us in the Gulkana River case that the transportation of people via commercial guides was sufficient transportation for the purpose of commerce. The second thing we look at is whether the waterway must The waterway must be usable for transportation conducted in customary modes of trade and travel on water. What that means is we're talking about the type of watercraft that you use, and when we're talking about navigability for fact, we're focused on the date of statehood. So what the Supreme Court has told us that is that you can use evidence of current day travel on the waterway as long as the watercraft that you're using today are materially similar to the watercraft that existed at the time of statehood. So for Alaska, we kind of have a little bit of an upper advantage to some of the other states in that our statehood is 1959, and generally in some of the litigation that we are talking about, we're talking about canoes. We have evidence of airboat use in the state prior to 1959. The disagreement that we generally have with BLM is over jet boats. And we do have evidence of jet boats, both in Anchorage and Fairbanks prior to 1959. So we say jet boat use is relevant. BLM says it's not. So that's one of the issues that we continue to fight about with the United States. The third thing that we generally focus on is whether the waterway is in its natural and ordinary condition. It has to be navigable in its natural and ordinary condition. So under the federal test, when you're talking about a navigable waterway, the federal government can actually go in and dredge a waterway and make it navigable, and then they can reach in and regulate it via their Commerce Clause powers. The state can't do that. And so that kind of gets back to whether the present day use is relevant. If a waterway has been dredged and made more navigable, then we can't necessarily just focus on present day use as easily as if it hadn't been dredged. So Mosquito Fork, I think we're all generally about familiar with the Mosquito Fork litigation. That was in its natural and ordinary condition. So I could very easily argue to the court, listen, DNR navigated it in 2012 in an inflatable raft carrying 1,000 pounds. Because it's in its same condition today as it was in 1959, that means you could have done it in 1959. So that's kind of what that test is referring to. And then I've already mentioned this a couple of times. The fourth thing is that we have to focus on whether the river was navigable at the time of statehood. So we all relate back to 1959. With DNR, we have basically three ways to actually get a clear title to our navigable waters. That can be done through federal quiet title litigation. So we generally are litigating against the United States in these types of cases, or recordable disclaimers of interest. And that's, again, with the United States, their RDI program, we're going to talk about a little bit later, both Jim and I, and is an administrative process that the United States has where they can disclaim their interest. And so DNR will file an application and say, we think this is a state-owned waterway because it is a navigable waterway. BLM does their research, and then they'll either agree with us and issue a disclaimer of interest, or they won't agree with us. And then the third way is through state court litigation. So here we have some recent examples of our quiet title litigation. I've talked with the committee members before about the Mosquito Fork River and the Stikine River cases. Those cases have both been closed, but I think it's important we circle back to the Mosquito Fork litigation. That was basically the first case that we filed in kind of our recent push to quiet title to the submerged lands. And that was the one where we litigated for 3 years, and the United States ultimately disclaimed their interest, but we filed some motions, and what we received was a court decision saying that the United States had acted in bad faith by pursuing frivolous legal arguments throughout the course of that litigation, and we ended up getting an award of $600,000 in attorney's fees. And that's an important case to keep mentioning because it's sort of the springboard for our most recent success, which is some of the other rivers that you see on this slide. The Kinnick is still kind of, it is an ongoing litigation. What happened in that one is BLM purported to convey portions of the bed to Aklutna. We asked them to reconsider. They didn't want to do that in a timely fashion, so we filed a litigation, and ultimately the United States did disclaim their interest in the Kinnick River. We followed up with 180-day notice both on the Delta River and the Kisaralik. So before we file a litigation against the United States, we have to give them 180 days of notice, basically, and that allows them to consider whether they're going to defend their title or whether they're going to disclaim their interest. In both the Delta River and the Kisaralik, we filed 180-day notice, and the United States ultimately recognized the state's ownership before we filed litigation. The Kisaralik is actually a little bit unique in that we had filed an application for an RDI. BLM denied it. I asked them to reconsider. They said they were going to reconsider, and then basically I said, please do it within 180 days or we're going to file litigation. And they did it with 180 days, within 180 days, and granted DNR's RDI application. The 40 Mile River, the West Fork, and the Denison Fork, basically we filed 180-day notice on four rivers, the West Fork, the Denison Fork, the Middle Fork of the 40 Mile, and the North Fork of the 40 Mile. Prior to the expiration of the 180-day notice, the BLM came back and issued revised NAV determinations, finding the West Fork and the Denison Fork navigable. So they recognized the state's ownership in that, but they did not find, or they haven't addressed the state's claims to the North Fork and the Middle Fork of the 40 Mile. So in October of last year, we filed a quiet title action to clear title to those two rivers. We haven't received an answer yet back from the United States. It's been a little bit of delay because of the government shutdown. I think their answer is due by the end of the month. So we'll see whether they're going to disclaim their interest or we're going to litigate, basically. And then, as you can see here, DNR has filed a bunch of additional 180-day notices on the Koyukuk, the Bettles, the Dietrich, the Birch Creek, and the Beaver Creek, and those will all expire soon. So we're waiting to hear back whether DNR or whether BLM intends to go forth with their claim of ownership or potentially issue new revised navigability determinations. And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Walker, and I am the manager of the Public Access Assertion and Defense Unit. And I'm going to talk for a little bit about our RDI program before handing it back to Jesse, and just some general observations about the level of work that we have left. As you can see from this slide, if we consider all efforts that the state has made from the time of statehood to date, we have successfully cleared title through all the processes, including the RDIs, including quiet title litigation and so forth, to approximately 14% of the submerged lands under navigable lakes and 6% of the submerged lands under navigable rivers. I'm not great at math, but when you consider we're 60 years into this, we have a lot of work left to do. One of the ways that we are working closely with law, with our partners in Fish and Game and others, is to come up with ways in which we could possibly clear that title more quickly. And one of the things that I'll be discussing later in the presentation that we've come up with is, and we're working very hard on, is a way of doing basin-wide, watershed-wide, catchment-wide determinations of navigable waters based upon sound science and sound law, in the hopes that we could use that to effectively clear title more quickly. I'll be addressing that more later. But the second way that Jesse had indicated we can go about clearing our titles is through our RDI program. And again, that stands for Recordable Disclaimer of Interest. And it is pursuant to the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, or FLPMA, that we have this RDI process. And basically, it works as essentially a quit claim deed. When there has not been a valid pre-statehood withdrawal, we apply to BLM and say, we would like to get a quit claim deed, essentially, from you, saying that you have no interest in these submerged lands, and an agreement that the waters above the submerged lands are navigable. This is the way that BLM prefers that we proceed. It does not have the confrontation of a lawsuit. It is an administrative process, and it has been successful over the years. However, it has been painfully slow, and it has been expensive. And I'll give you a few examples there. We recently received an RDI, Recordable Disclaimer of Interest, from BLM to Lake Besheroff and Igigigik Lake. Now, for those of you who are familiar, Lake Besheroff is the second largest lake in the state of Alaska, after Iliamna. It covers a surface area of over 450 square miles. It has an average depth of 100 feet. It is, in its deepest place, over 400 feet deep. We had to wait several years and pay approximately $10,000 for BLM to tell us that that was navigable. It can be a very frustrating process. It can be slow. It can involve a lot of red tape. But we are proceeding with that, and Jesse's going to talk about in just a few minutes some possibilities that we may have for improving that project. Jesse, if we could go to the next slide. These are examples of some of the RDIs that we have received in the past few years. And many of you will be familiar with a lot of these. The Taku River, for example, is one. Lake Minchumina and others that I'm sure members of the committee are very familiar with. And as I indicated, there is a possibility for improvements contained within this RDI process that Jesse has been involved with us in connection with that Knik River litigation that she previously mentioned.
Mr. Chairman, again, Jesse Alloway for the record. So when I was talking about the Knik, basically, the biggest part of that case had been resolved because the United States disclaimed their interest. And after they do that, I file a motion to establish the state status as a prevailing party. And it's kind of a quirky legal thing that we do, but it's important because that was a legal theory that allowed us to get attorney's fees in the Mosquito Fork case, basically. And essentially it is, previously you didn't recognize the state's ownership, you claimed ownership yourself, United States. We filed litigation and you changed course because of that litigation, therefore the state is the prevailing party. In the Knik litigation, that resulted in us getting $400 in costs. But the United States appealed that to the Ninth Circuit. And the only thing at issue is that prevailing party and those $400 in costs. It's not, the ownership of the Knik River is not at issue. So the United States is part of the Ninth Circuit appeal process. You have to sit down with the mediator, and the United States reached out to me and said, as part of this mediation, we would like to work with DNR and try to figure out ways that we can improve the RDI process to make it more likely that the state will file an RDA rather than filing litigation. So we are going through that process right now. It's been in the course, I think we started it sometime last year around this time. And I'm waiting for the United States to give us a proposal in writing so I can brief the new administration. But essentially what's at issue and part of the problem with using the RDI process as opposed to litigation is what Jim was saying, is that what was happening when we used the RDI process was we file an application and then we have to pay BLM to engage in their own research to determine whether the United States is going to claim their interest. And that number was unreasonably high in the state's opinion. And then there was no timeline for which BLM had to act. And so some of these RDI applications that we had filed prior to the Mosquito Fork litigation, there was no decision even 5 to 10 years after we had filed the application. But when we use litigation, what happens is we file a complaint and then the United States on their own dime has to figure out whether they're going to claim an interest or they're going to disclaim it. And we have court-imposed deadlines. So I can grant extensions or I can agree to extensions by the United States, but if we think they're taking too long, then we can go to the judge and we can say we need a decision. So this cost issue is part of one of the major issues that we're discussing in the mediation, as well as whether we can have an agreement with BLM on some of the legal issues that I was referring to before, like what is a customary boat? What do we need to show two-way traffic? So the United States will take the position that it has to be a highway, so you have to go up and down. We say, no, we don't. You can just float down it. Part of the reason that we say you can just float down it is that there's a Ninth Circuit decision that say log drives are sufficient evidence of a highway of commerce. And my point to the United States is logs don't float upstream. So it's just one-way traffic, and that's sufficient. So those are sort of the issues that we're talking about in this mediation process.
If we are able to achieve a new going forward with BLM with regards to the RDI program, obviously we will ramp up the number of applications that we make. This is a list that we have provided to BLM of RDI applications that we are prepared to make and to make in the immediate future. We are holding back on filing many of these, awaiting the outcome. We are looking for a commitment from them that possibly they may waive those costs. We would have to pay the application fee and necessary statutory notice cost, publishing in the newspaper, that type of thing. But all of their processing and administrative fees, we would not be taxed. That's one of the things that we're asking for. We're also asking that they devote necessary capacity to processing these applications so that we can get results in a timely fashion. A few years ago, when the RDI program first came online, there were 13 dedicated staff. I'm advised there were 13 dedicated staff working on navigability issues. There's presently one person who is working on them as part of his additional duties. So it is a capacity, it is a cost, and it is also just a disagreement about the legal standards that are going to be applied as we look at these navigability questions. That's what's at stake in this CONNECT mediation, and we'll see what happens. Nevertheless, we will continue on with our efforts on the RDI program, and many of the committee members will recognize a number of the rivers listed up here. And this goes also through the chair to Senator Coghill's question earlier about various land planning and whatnot that the federal government is doing. Oftentimes, we will ask our colleagues in government, what are the rivers that are important to you to have a clear definition of state title to? And if it is one that is not had the title cleared on, we will look at it and we'll say, is this something we could proceed with an RDI so that we have that clarity of title, which would assist state efforts in the planning process? Many of the rivers that we are looking at, both in terms of litigation as well as in RDIs, are within that 5150 corridor and elsewhere within that Central Yukon plan that Brent Goodrum talked about earlier. And you'll recognize many of the names of those from that. A third way that we can clear or attempt to clear state title to submerged lands is through our state navigability determinations. And this is something within our control, and it is an administrative matter. Historically, we've used these when, for example, the Department of Transportation needs to know, oh, who owns this particular lake or whatever for their particular needs. They'll ask for our opinion, and we'll give it to them. But we have increasingly sought to apply our thinking, our approach, our efforts, our views to making these state navigability determinations in the hopes that this could start a new narrative with our colleagues over at on the federal side, that we could say, we believe that this is what you need to do to establish navigability, and we'll lay it forth in these state navigability determinations so that we can essentially indicate that we have analyzed this, and we believe that we do, in fact, own these submerged lands. So in these state navigability determinations, as the PowerPoint slide shows, we will be focusing on things such as susceptibility and physical characteristics. We will also be going through with our scientific analysis and a legal analysis to establish that we do in fact own these, and thereby set a new standard, we believe, in our dealings with the federal government. And that brings me to, excuse me, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just, Mr. Walker, a little help for the new guy. That would then be a prelude to filing an RDI or litigation or something that would, I mean, is it, this is an initial step on the way to what you were describing earlier, or is it a new method altogether?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, it would be kind of all of the above. For example, if we issued a state navigability determination, we said that these submerged lands belong to the state of Alaska, and based upon that navigability determination, we were to permit certain activities. If the federal government were to object to that, they would end up suing us, and we would then be in court litigating over the validity of it, and it would be on the terms that we have set in our state navigability determination. It could also be used as a predicate for an RDI application in an appropriate case. And also, much of what I'm going to talk about in terms of our work with navigability and whatnot is also used in our federal quiet title litigation as well. Does that answer your question, sir?
I think it does. I may follow up later about whether that puts the permit holder, once we issue a permit, at some greater risk, but maybe for the time.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the issues that I wanted to touch upon is what we call the Navigability Metrics Project. And what we're trying to do with this project is come up with that solution that I referenced earlier to our problem of how are we going to get the title cleared in a shorter period of time. Is there some way, as opposed to looking at a river segment by segment, can we look at a basin in its entirety? Can we look at a catchment? Can we look at a drainage? And is there some way that we could, instead of clearing title river mile by river mile, clear it basin wide? Thumbs up, thumbs down, it is navigable, or these are ones that there might be a question about. So that's our challenge, that what we're trying to do is come up with a way based upon sound science in which we can determine whether a particular water body is boatable using data and other factors that are available to us remotely that minimize our requirement to go out oftentimes for years at a time and study a particular river so that we have sufficient evidence to bring our case. In other words, we want to look at all of the data that's available to us and decide, can we say whether that criterion watercraft that was of the type in use at statehood, could it have boated, could it have navigated factually this river in question? And as we've looked at this, we have come up with a list of the factors that we have identified, the size of the catchment, the length of the open water season. Obviously, in the southeast, the open water season is going to be longer than the open water season for a river in the far north. I'll come back to the Strahler stream order classification because this kind of will give you, in a nutshell, of where we're going with this project. We look at the precipitation. We look at the hydraulic geometry. How about that? The flow rate, the width, the gradient, the channel pattern, the substrate, the dimensions of the watercraft, and the reasonableness of the portage. What we're not trying to do is invent the wheel all over again. Instead, we're trying to take basic hydrology, basic science that we have through fish passage studies, through exceedance modeling that engineers use when constructing bridges and dams and things of that nature. Other efforts made by states to categorize and inventory their rivers, and basic principles of hydraulic geometry. And when we combine all of that, what we're trying to do is come up with a way that we can reliably say that the rivers within a particular basin are not, or may be navigable. And let's look at the Strehler stream order classification. This is one of the tools that we're using. And this follows what I think everybody believes, you know, common knowledge with any river. It starts in the headwaters, is a trickle up in the mountain, and then it collects with other trickles, and it becomes a creek, and then it becomes a stream, and then the streams join together, and then they ultimately become rivers. The rivers may even further join and become even bigger rivers. And based upon that modeling, which is true anywhere you have rivers, you can classify, based upon this system, rivers throughout the United States. So on the next slide, you'll see that in the middle, we see the Mississippi River, which is listed as a Strehler classification 10. You'll see other rivers you may recognize, the Ohio, the Tennessee, the Rio Grande, etc. And these all have a particular classification which generally correlates with their size. This has not been done throughout Alaska, and that is what we are doing right now. So we are applying this to, for example, the Yukon River Basin and comparing it to other basins throughout the rest of the United States. And in general, the Yukon River Basin generally resembles the Mississippi River Basin in certain respects. It's different, but it's similar in certain respects. And when we consider various tributaries of the Mississippi, like we consider the various tributaries of the Yukon, we can see that there are similarities, and we can make conclusions based upon that science. Let's look at a few examples that we have seen up here. Jess, if we go to the next one. This is the 40 Mile Basin, and we've talked about rivers up there, including West Fork and Denison Fork, that the federal government has recently disclaimed. And you'll see that those are Strehler stream order fives. So we see, a five is something that the federal government considers navigable. What other ones are five or better? If we could go to the next slide. We'll see, for example, on the Mosquito Fork River, these are photographs taken from various segments within the Mosquito Fork River. It looks, to my eye, very navigable, and that's exactly what the court concluded. So if we take that and apply that elsewhere, we can see if it's navigable here, a Strehler 5, it's probably navigable there as well. So if we could go to the next slide. The Denison Fork, another one that they just recently disclaimed. And again, looking at the water, that looks completely navigable. And it is completely navigable. And then we'll go to the next one where we see the Kandik and the Nation Rivers. And again, these are rivers that the court has declared navigable. So if this is what navigability looks like on the Kandik and the Nation, shouldn't other rivers that look like this similarly be navigable? And that's where we're working with this. And again, not delving too much into this, the science of this, but what we are hoping to do with this project is do two things. One, we would like to partner with the federal government. We would like to show them this science. We would like to work with USGS or whomever and say, we believe that this is a scientifically valid way of determining the boatability and factual navigability of rivers. Do you have contributions that you would like to make? Are there ways that we could tease out points of controversy? But see if we could partner together. And we are in the process of doing our best to brief up the leadership of DOI on these ideas right now. And hopefully that will receive a good audience there. But also we're hoping to use these methodologies in our state navigability determinations and then maybe possibly ultimately in our federal litigation once it's proven. Yes, sir.
I just had a question on navigability. I mean, we're focused on navigability, but, you know, for thousands of years, the rivers in interior Alaska have been, you know, usual and customary use for maybe 6 months of the year has been, you know, a transportation corridor. Is it all centered on navigability, or is there any, I mean, obviously in Alaska, rivers and tributaries are pretty good you know, I mean, you're driving cars on them and so, you know, all sorts of equipment. I'm just wondering, is it all got to be centered on navigability, or is there any latitude to look at other historic and purposeful use of those same waterways?
I'm going to defer, if I may, Chairman, to Jesse Alloway, who can more eloquently answer that from the legal standpoint.
Chairman Birch, yes. The courts tell us that we have to focus on navigability. So basically the idea was that all of these navigable waterways were used for commerce, and either the state or the federal government needs to control them. But the court has always said navigability is like a boat or water-driven test. Other cases have suggested, you know, in the frozen state, ATVs, snow machines, that sort of things. But the courts so far haven't bought that, and it's boat-driven.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Kosar.
Thank you. Just a question on for glacier-fed streams and things like that that were pre or post-statehood. I mean, they're melting at an alarming rate. Are they changing, and how were those dealt with when it comes to navigability?
Senator, through the chair, that's an interesting question. Like, we would, again, have to focus on the natural and ordinary condition. And we might have touched on this in the Kinnick River litigation, because in the Kinnick, you have Lake George that used to just flood and create sort of a high water state in the summer, and that hasn't happened. So the question that I would ask the hydrologist is, how often did that happen pre-statehood? And when it did happen, did it make the Kinnick more or less navigable? So we would kind of have to answer those questions, and then we would have to look at what the difference is today. And because the glaciers are melting faster, is that making the waterway more navigable or less navigable? Since they're melting quickly, you'd probably suggest that it would make it more navigable. The second question that I would have is, none of that is... I suppose you could argue that's a man-made change. I'd also want to argue that it's not a man-made change, right? So you'd have sort of a legal question: is that the natural and ordinary condition, kind of as the world changes? And so you'd have some legal questions that you'd have to address going forward. But I understand your point.
Super. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you, Ms. Dalloway. Senator Giesel.
So. Streams and rivers aren't ditches.
Right.
They actually are often contributed to significantly by groundwater. I think, for example, of Rabbit Creek in Anchorage, which right now is flowing quite well. It's flowing because of groundwater. So in your slide that says factors influencing boatability, which of these words refers to groundwater contribution to a stream or river?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I would say that the precipitation, even though groundwater is not precipitation, just for purposes of summary fashion, I would include it in that. But you are absolutely right that the subsurface waters are going to affect the flow of any given river, and that is something that we would also consider.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And lastly, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, one of the things that we're hoping to do with the work that we're doing on this navigability metrics process is publish a series of articles in the scientific journals to get through peer-reviewed process other scientists, other hydrologists to support, back, and vouch for the methodology that we're using here. We have in the offing right now papers that are touching upon such subjects as a comprehensive listing of all types of boats that were used at the time of statehood within the state, their dimensions, their carrying capacities, their drafts, things of that nature, so that we can establish once and for all whether the watercraft that we're now using, which we believe to be, were substantially similar to those in use at the time of statehood. We're also publishing papers on the methodologies that we're using and other topics. As you can see by some of the litigation history since the Mosquito Fork decision, generally there has been a series of disclaimers, one after the other, at various levels in the litigation process. That's a great thing, but it also frustrates our ability to establish good case law, binding precedent that we can use. And in the absence of that binding precedent, we thought about it among ourselves and we said, why don't we seek to establish that precedent in the scientific literature if we are not getting it through the court opinions? And that's something that we're working on very hard right now in the unit. That is, absent any questions, the remarks I would have on that topic, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, before I move on to my next favorite topic, which is RS-2477, so just a point of clarification, given that I'm the attorney and I have to correct the record. In the Mosquito Fork litigation, we actually didn't receive a decision from the court that it was navigable to the United States recognized or disclaimed their interest. So just in case BLM is watching the presentation and I don't want to hear about it later. Second, to answer Senator Keel's question about the state NAV determinations, recently we had a situation where DNR issued a state NAV determination and issued mooring buoy permits to public users so that they could access the submerged lands and basically tie up their float plane to access this lake. And the question in that litigation, it was appealed to the Superior Court, was when DNR doesn't have a court decision saying that a lake is navigable, in fact, can they exercise their management authority? And the argument that I made to the court is, you know, DNR is responsible for managing state land, and we can't be put in a situation where we have to quiet title to everything. And basically, DNR needed to take action to manage public user conflicts. And the court agreed with me in that situation. The court didn't want to go so far as quieting title in sort of an administrative appeal, but he said DNR's decision was not arbitrary, it was reasonable, it followed the law, and because of that, it upheld the commissioner's decision to issue those mooring buoy permits, so the public could use those and access that lake via those permits. So I hope that answers your question. Moving on to RS-2477. So RS-2477, it's basically a federal land grant that the state could accept two ways, either via an affirmative state act, either through the territory or through the state, or by public use. And basically, public users or the state would accept a right-of-way over federal public land, unappropriated public land. And as you can see from the slide, we have several litigations where we're trying to address some of the issues that come up with an RS-2477 cases, the first being the Dixon case, and I'm going to defer to Jim. He'll give you the details on that one.
That was a case that was, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that was a case that was recently considered by the Alaska Supreme Court, and it originated in the Mat-Su Valley, where a portion of the National Historic Iditarod Trail was blocked by two landowners who contended that the trail did not cross their property, it went elsewhere. We were sued by the landowners to quiet title, and we responded and conducted a lengthy trial in the Superior Court in Anchorage, and the judge ruled in our favor in all respects. That decision was appealed to the Alaska Supreme Court, and in its opinion, it affirmed the trial court on all substantive areas. There is a question regarding the attorney's fees, which we were awarded. We were awarded approximately $250,000 in attorney's fees in that case. The court remanded it to determine whether or not there needed to be more findings on the attorney's fees issue, and the court asked for some clarification there, and that's what we're presently briefing. But in all substantive respects, we prevailed in that decision. And it has established for us very helpful precedent that we are going to be able to use in cases in the future to protect our RS-2477 network statewide.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, moving on to the Cloutina Lake Road litigation. This is the litigation that was originally filed by ATNA in 2008. I believe the committee members are probably pretty familiar with the Cloutina Lake Road litigation, so I'll focus on giving you an update. It's an important case because basically it's going to touch on all of the important issues in an RS-2477 litigation, namely like how it's accepted, First being the state's arguing that it was accepted by public use, particularly by Gold Rush users in 1898 through 1899, and then even throughout the early 20th century. And second, we're arguing that the state affirmatively accepted it by entering into a contract in 1964 by a gentleman named Mr. Brenwick, that's why it's also named the Brenwick-Craig Road, to build a road from the Richardson Highway all the way to Coutina Lake. So we have basically the two types of acceptances in this litigation. The litigation will also touch on the scope of the RS-2477 and what you can do within an RS-2477. The court has already issued a decision, partial motion for summary judgment, ruling in favor of Aetna, where it said that an RS-2477 is only for ingress or egress, and that you can't camp and engage in other activities within an RS-2477. That's potentially an appeal point for the state, particularly if you think about it with the Coutina Lake Road. So what happens with the Coutina Lake Road is you leave the Richardson and you would drive down it, and at various points you can just access Coutina River, right? And Coutina River is in itself a navigable, in fact, waterway. It's a transportation corridor. So it doesn't make a lot of sense for the court to say that someone has to get on the Richardson and drive basically all the way to the end of the RS-2477, which we would say is Valdez, without having the opportunity to access the other transportation corridor via a boat launch, which would be to hop into the Coutina River or get to Coutina Lake. So that's sort of an issue that we're not giving up hope on, and we could potentially appeal. As the committee is well aware, at various points throughout this now over 10-year litigation, the state has tried to settle the litigation with Aetna. The most recent attempt was in 2016, and ultimately the board rejected the settlement agreement. But since that time, the state has received a couple of important decisions in favor of the state. The first being that the court ruled that if the state can establish the existence of an RS-2477, it will be 100 feet wide as a matter of law, and that's via the state statute. The second being it rejected Aetna's argument that, or its claim of aboriginal title. So essentially, when I told you the grant was for a right-of-way over unappropriated public land, Aetna was arguing that it wasn't unappropriated federal land because they had a claim of aboriginal title, so the RS-2477 could never attach. The counter to that argument is basically ANCSA extinguished aboriginal title. And even if there was a claim of aboriginal title, basically the RS-2477 was kind of over top of it, and as soon as ANCSA was extinguished aboriginal title, the RS-2477 attached. And the court agreed with that, and he rejected their motion for partial summary judgment. So where we're at right now is we have a trial that is starting in April 15th, 2019. So very, it's fast approaching, and basically I spend all of my time working on Coutina. The state has filed a motion for summary judgment to establish the existence of the RS-2477. That has been briefed, and we have oral argument on that before Judge Greedy on February 21st. We're making sort of an alternative argument, one being he can rule that the state has the entire RS-2477 based on the Gold Rush, or he could grant a partial motion for summary judgment and say that the state, relying on the 1964 contract, has an RS-2477 from the Richardson to Coutina Lake. And then what we would have to litigate after that point would be from Coutina Lake around the North Shore to state-owned land, basically the North Shore access. So we'll see what happens with those motions. The state is prepared to go to trial in April. The second RS-2477 litigation that we are currently engaged in is the litigation in Chicken, and this is with the federal government. And basically, we're trying to establish RS-2477's important access points in multiple wild and scenic corridors in the 40-mile area. And this litigation has been hung up with appeals, and part of the issue was that The RS-2477 leaves Chicken, travels north, and then it goes through a native allotment, and you have to go through that a native allotment to get to the other points that we're talking about. And the court said it didn't have jurisdiction over the quiet title action for the native allotment. So what we've been doing in the last year or 2 years is proceeding with a condemnation action to ensure or perfect the public access via the native allotment so that we can proceed with the case against the federal government. In this fall, September of last year, we received a favorable decision in the condemnation proceedings. Basically, the judge said that there was authority and necessity and said that the just compensation award was $8,400. That case has been appealed to the Ninth Circuit. But nevertheless, even though that has been appealed, we have filed a motion to lift the stay on the part of the case against the federal government. The court granted that motion, and so we're now going to proceed against the federal government to try to quiet title to those RS-2477s.
Just as a matter of legal, do they see that as private property or federal holding property? An allotment.
The native allotment? Mr. Senator, through the chair, they see that as private property. So the native allotment is private property, but the federal government still owns, or not owns, but it has an interest, kind of as parentage to the native allottee owner. So that's the legal quirk that deprived the federal court of jurisdiction. And the state hasn't given up its claims to the RS-2477s across the native allotment. It's just we can't quiet title to them. So to make sure that there was no conflict with public users and we weren't putting public users at risk, basically the state went and bought the RS-2477s that we believe we already had in order to pursue the rest of the case against the federal government.
Thank you.
No, proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next thing we'd like to talk about is some 17B easements and a scenario that we are working hard to replicate in other places throughout the state. For many of you are familiar with the Kinnick River Public Use Area, very popular destination between the Mat-Su Valley and Anchorage, lots of users, very popular area. Immediately in the center, largely bisecting the Kinnick River Public Use Area, is a area of land that was selected by Eklutna Corporation, and it's called generally the Friday Creek Drainage, the Friday Creek Conveyance. And they have selected these lands, and it was going to essentially bisect both sides of the Kinnick River Public Use Area. So being able to access one side to the other was vital so that users could enjoy both sides of it. This is a controversy that has gone back to the 1980s involving BLM, Eklutna Corporation, various private landowners in the state, and it's gone back and forth, back and forth, back and forth over time. We were recently able, through what I consider to be a pretty historic agreement with Eklutna, that we would all agree on where those 17B easements would be, with the understanding that in a popular area such as this, people are going to cross your lands. Wouldn't it be better if we had certain corridors clearly marked, clearly identified, so that folks could pass from state land to state land with minimal interruption, minimal damage to the private property. In connection with this, we have been working with various user groups who have stepped forward and offered to help with signage and education and other processes to minimize the trespassing on Eklutna lands. But Eklutna gave a considerable amount to the state as well. They recognized that because of Friday Creek's unpredictability and variation from year to year, that not just one, but two crossings of Friday Creek would be preserved. So that some years, Route A would be the better way to cross, other years, Route B would be the better way to cross, as opposed to having a trespass situation arise every other year, let's create two. we received important considerations, and we also made important agreements on behalf of the state. And our hope is that this partnership, where we're working with user groups, addressing the native corporations directly, and with a spirit of compromise and going forward, that we can bottle this up and sprinkle it on other controversies throughout Alaska, bringing the parties together, being realistic, and recognizing with respect how we are going to balance what I believe can be balanced, namely private property rights and public access. And that is something that we're working on with other areas of controversy throughout the state.
Senator Rangel?
It was in the final comments.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, proceed. Thank you. Lastly, the last slide we have is that we are working and attempting to establish with our counterparts in the federal government a way of preserving RS-2477s across federal lands. It is in everyone's best interest, we believe, to have these recognized and identified and preserved so that users know where to go and how to get there. And there has been, as we see in the chicken litigation, a historic resistance on the federal government's part to recognize RS-2477s. We are hoping that with the new leadership in the Department of the Interior and whatnot, that we are going to be able to make an appeal and have, as it has the authority to do, have the federal government issue non-binding RS-2477 determinations against across federal lands so that we can preserve these. Because as everyone on the committee is well aware, with an RS-2477, we're not getting any new ones. They had to be established before the cutoff date. Now, there may be ones that are undocumented that other qualifies and acceptances of the grants during the appropriate time, but we can't create a new one today. And that means that the way we prove these cases becomes more and more difficult with the passage of time, as witnesses die, users die, memories fail, etc. So if we are able, with working with the Department of Interior, to record these non-binding RS-2477 determinations against federal lands, it would be very advantageous on an ongoing basis for the state.
Very good. Thank you.
These questions, we've been asking questions all the way up. Excellent brief, excellent presentation, very, very helpful. See if there's any questions.
Just real quick, I wanted to just, one, say the U.S., the feds, in other words, when you refer to the U.S., the feds, I just hope that they fight for the United States' rights as hard as they fight you guys, you know, for rights up in the Arctic, because as climate does change, those pathways are going to open up, and there might not be that many traditional uses, you know, up there. So I think there's just a broad horizon up there. But I also want to really encourage you guys to fight for the traditional use of in the winter as well. I mean, Alaskans move around year-round, whether it was dog sled or whatever, and I'm just shocked that they don't recognize that, you know, navigability. And then last, I just wanted to say it was a fascinating presentation. So, Chair Birch, I really want to say thank you. Thank you, three. I think Alaska has an amazing team. You guys are really a force to be reckoned with, and I just want to encourage you to keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
I know it's outside of the scope of this, but and you don't have to answer it entirely right now, but on these areas of environmental concern, I am truly concerned. I think on the various different planning areas, the Federal Land Policy Act is trumping what we agreed to in ANILCA, and I hope that in your legal team and in any way we can help, that we're moving forward. So do we have any legal action at this point, and is there anything that we can do to undergird your work on asserting the No More Clause, basically?
Senator, through the chair, I am not aware of any. I do know we have someone within the Department of Law that focuses on that and makes sure that we work with the agencies to submit timely comments and things like that, but I would have to get back to you on a more thorough answer.
So the Department of Law probably is going to be the key. It's just that as land managers, your particular department, your the PAD group is going to be someplace that we'll lean on to make sure that good background is brought to bear. And I think it has a lot of impact on what you're doing on both recordable disclaimers and RS-2477. So it could cloud that once again, just like the D-1 clouds so many other things. So
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other thing that makes this hearing so valuable is that Senator Bishop is the chair of the Finance Subcommittee for DNR. And this is the kind of team that we need to keep in place and funded to continue to fight for statehood rights. So thank you.
Well, I just wanted to, Senator Keel.
Can we just back up one slide? I want to register. I have an issue with your map.
Noted, Senator.
No.
You have a lot of navigable water.
Well, I want to I absolutely want to thank the department for a very informative presentation and for fighting the good fight on behalf of all Alaskans in defending and asserting our public access rights. It's very important. And thank the committee for being here this afternoon. The next committee meeting will be held at 3:30 p.m. Friday, February 8th, where we'll take up the governor's appointees to the Big Game Commercial Services Board and the Fisherman's Fund Advisory and Appeals Council. With that, we are adjourned at 5 p.m.